As much of the world argues about the legacy of Fidel Castro, here at Amandla, we are unabashedly paying tribute to the Cuban leader and the untold tens of thousands of Cubans, doctors, teachers, fighters, engineers, who put their shoulder to the wheel of solidarity and stood strong against colonial and neocolonial domination in Africa. As Nelson Mandela so famously wrote from his infamous jail cell on Robben Island, upon hearing of the arrival of Cuban troops in Angola in 1975, quote, "It was the first time that a country had come from another continent not to take something away, but to help Africans achieve their freedom." Joining us tonight to reflect on Cuba under Fidel Castro and its unique relationship with Africa is Professor Isaac Saini, who teaches history at Dalhousie University and St. Mary's University and is the co-chair and national spokesperson for the Canadian Network on Cuba. He's the author of Cuba, A Revolution in Motion, and the soon-to-be-released Africa's Children Return, Cuba, The War in Angola, and the End of Apartheid. Professor Saini, welcome to Amandla.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's talk about Cuitoquana Valley. This is not exactly a household term here in Canada, but for Angolans, Namibians, South Africans, and really for all of Southern Africa, it's synonymous with the beginning of the end of apartheid and the very special role that Cuba played in that decisive event. It's an amazing moment in history, and as I said, one that probably very few Canadians are aware of. So could you tell us the story of Cuitoquana Valley?
Well, Cuitoquana Valley was remembered as a moment in the sort of Angola. Sort of historical background to this battle in which the racist South African apartheid forces were dealt a decisive defeat. It's important to understand that as Mozambique, Angola's countries around South Africa became independent, as black independent nations emerged on the racist state's borders, South Africa increasingly saw its survival as a racist state, as a white minority state, as increasingly tied to achieving regional domination in Southern Africa. So it actively attempted to destabilize and undermine the independent black republics, particularly Mozambique and particularly Angola. And Angola happened to be the major arena. So in 1975, South Africa, with the support of the United States, invaded Angola to topple the MPLA government and to establish a puppet state. And of course, there was an invasion from Zaire, then under the dictatorship of Mobutu. Mm-hmm. The Angolans then issued an international SOS calling on countries to assist them. And Cuba, precisely because of its a long relationship with the MPLA and the Angolan Liberation Movement, was able to dispatch what amounted to eventually 36,000 troops and actually play a critical role in defeating the South African invasion and therefore preserving the independence of Angola. And as you were pointing out in your very eloquent and powerful introduction, it's important to understand this was the first defeat of the so-called invincible White Army of South Africa. And so what happened was, you know, it's important to understand too what's been forgotten is that from 1975 to around 1988, South Africa waged a war of terror. It's usually referred to as a war of destabilization, mm-hmm. costing hundreds of thousands of lives and causing untold billions in damages, right? So the Cuban troops stayed there at the request of the Angolans as a bulwark of continued South African aggression. One key episode in that aggression, one of the most famous cases, is the May 4th, 1978 attack on the Kasinga refugee camp. Kasinga was a place inside Angola where Namibian refugees were staying, and hundreds of people were killed by this South African paratroop attack. It was a terrorist attack. I mean, South Africans described it as the most perfect assault in terms of the people they killed and, of course, the people they kidnapped. So that's an example of this war of terror. So in 1988, as you were talking about Cuitoquana Valley, the Angolans were involved in an offensive against UNITA, which really was a puppet creation of the United States and South Africa and support. And basically, it waged a guerrilla war inside Angola, and the whole goal was that UNITA eventually, under Zavimbi, would be installed as a puppet regime under the control of South Africa. This would destroy the independence of Angola. And so what happened was, as the Angolan army was on the verge of destroying UNITA, South Africa massively intervened. And they intervened to save UNITA, but this intervention was so successful from the South African perspective, right? And they killed so many Angolan soldiers that the South Africans became emboldened. For again, they had an opportunity that landed in their laps to deal a fatal blow to Angola as an independent state. Mm-hmm. So as Angola's troops retreated back to Cuito Cuanaval, which was the base from which the operation was launched, the Angolans were in a dire situation, and they asked Cuba for assistance. So Cuba sent additional troops and actually stripped the island of its best weapons, particularly around Havana, the anti-aircraft weapons and so forth. And this is the time when, you know, of course, the Reagan administration was particularly hyper-aggressive to Cuba. And in the context of this, the Cubans and the Angolans were able to hold the South Africans at Cuito Cuanaval, because the South Africans became obsessed of taking Cuito Cuanaval, and with their racist arrogance, they couldn't believe that a black and what they would call a race-mixed army could ever hold them. And as the South Africans were preoccupied with Cuito Cuanaval and held at Cuito Cuanaval, the Cubans and Angolans actually encircled them in an incredible outflanking maneuver. And this outflanking maneuver completely changed the military balance of power, forcing the South Africans to retreat back into Namibia. And that military defeat had very profound political repercussions within the South African regime, leading to the displacement of the military from the apex of state power and opening the way for the state to basically have to be forced to the negotiating table. And what led was out of that was South Africa had to basically concede to the independence of Namibia under the which South Africa illegally occupied since 1916. They had to accede to the independence of Namibia under the Southwest African People's People's Organization, which was a liberation movement, SWAPO, and eventually that had very profound consequences, eventually in leading to the release of Mandela and the acceleration of the end of apartheid. Now, I know I've given a very long story there, right?
A lot of information there.
But, you know, it's important to understand this because this has been forgotten. I know people think back when Mandela died in December of 2013 and they had the big commemorative ceremony, right? And there were four leaders that were given very prominent positions, i.e. speaking at Mandela's funeral. People looked at Raul Castro, who spoke at the end. He was the last person to speak before Zuma spoke. And people said, well, what is he speaking there? And the media didn't explain it. And they always spoke about Raul Castro, a prominent position there, as being a product of this very peculiar, strange, sort of inexplicable relationship or affection that Mandela had for Fidel Castro, without understanding that Mandela's affection and deep friendship and respect for Fidel was rooted in what Cuba did, this long struggle where close to 500,000 Cubans cycled through Africa in aiding the anti-colonial national liberation struggles, and where over 2,000 died shedding their blood. And Mandela himself repeatedly said that Cuba really is the only country to have come to Africa, right? Okay, and you know, and gone away simply with the honor of having fought for Africa rather than having taken away resources. So there's an African saying, I've heard it from several people in Southern Africa, that Cuba is the only country to have gone to Africa and gone away with nothing but the coffins of its sons and daughters who died in the struggles to liberate Africa. Yeah. And so this is a common theme. So I know I've spoken a lot about this, but it's the unknown story that people have hidden.
I agree. And there is so much in what you just said, and we are going to back up and look at some of this, but I agree in preparing for this interview with you today and kind of reading some of the mainstream press, what really struck me in everything, you know, BBC, The Guardian, Huffington Post, is this utter and absolute depoliticization of the relationship between Cuba and Southern Africa.
Yeah, well, and it's important to understand that Cuba has always felt they would, like when the rebel, there's always been this deep historical connection between Cuba and Africa, right? Mm-hmm. And it's important when you place it in the context of, you know, over a million enslaved Africans being bought to basically be consumed in the crucible of sugar plantations in Cuba, the resistance of Africans rebelling against slavery itself, then Africa becoming a very important component of the Cuban national liberation struggle, then Jose Marti, Cuba's national hero and intellectual author, in the 19th century, basically saying that, you know, black Cubans have to be granted equality and they have become there's an integral part of the national liberation struggle. And also when he leads the War of Independence from 1895 to 1898, it's not just a war of independence. It's, in a sense, a social revolution in which black Cubans the two very important positions. When the U.S. independent in 1898, they reversed all of that, right? Because they want to impose Jim Crow segregation. So Cuba's always had this very profound connection to Africa in terms of their contribution to Cuba's national liberation struggle, their contribution to Cuba's intellectual thought material, as I like to say, that guided the liberation struggles, right? And also culturally as well. So when the Cuban Revolution trams, it's building on this connection, right? But then it makes it explicit in terms of aiding anti-colonial national liberation struggles in Africa itself. So there was this feeling of a historic debt that because of the transatlantic slave trade, Cuba and humanity in general owed a historic debt to Africa. And so this was part and parcel of repaying that debt to Africa. And also Fidel Castro in the 1970s declared that Cuba was a Latin African nation, right? Valorizing the African component. Mm-hmm. And now in the 20th century, in the last two decades or so, there's been a very deepening debate and discussion in Cuba about, you know, the issue of race and also the issue of the African component, the integral African component, as being central in many ways to Cuba's history and to basically establishing the whole framework that intellectually guided Cuban national liberation struggles and so forth. And so when we get back to Africa itself, I mean, there was this profound connection. So there are interviews with Cuban soldiers who served there who made a reconnection to Africa because of their African descent. And there are Cubans who served there who were basically white, who also saw this as making a contribution, right, to repaying that historical debt to Africa. So it's an incredible story. And it's this objective history, this material history, that lays the basis for this profound respect that Africans have for Cuba and the iconic and heroic status that Fidel has in Africa, particularly in Southern Africa.
So really, I mean, in a way, the way you're describing it, and I'm understanding it, is that Cuba really fits into the history of Pan-Africanism in a very salient fashion.
Yeah, it is. And this is one of the things is that when I was writing my book and thinking about it, and so, is the, you know, there's various ways you can approach it. Cuba's internationalism towards Africa is part and parcel, for example, of historic traits that exist in Cuba, historic traditions. For example, Cubans often point to Hattuey, who was a cacique chief, chief of the Tainos, right, and who fled from Haiti to Cuba and then led resistance against the Spanish. So Cubans see him as being the first internationalist and the first person who actually intellectually articulated resistance, or at least the first recorded as episode of intellectual resistance to the Spanish. We have various people during the Cuban Wars of Independence, right, who came from other countries to aid them. So Cuba has a strong history of internationalism and so forth. And then, of course, there is the, you know, the proletarian internationalism embodied in Marxism, Leninism and so forth. Then there's the struggle against imperialism and so forth. But overlaying all of this when it comes to Africa, right, is this profound conception that there is a particular debt and a particular connection to Africa. Mm-hmm. So many people miss this Pan-African connection, right? Mm-hmm. And it's one, so in a sense, what Cuba did in Africa was one part of the African diaspora coming to the aid of Africa, which is a very profound story when you think about it in that perspective.
Absolutely. And I realized earlier I said something that wasn't quite correct when I was reading the kind of mainstream media coverage. It wasn't so much a depoliticization as a de-solidarityization. It was, in fact, a lot of the writing was very political, but it was very much scripted in the sense that Cuba was, you know, on the puppet strings of the Soviet Union. And in fact, that its agency in Africa had to do about Cold War struggle and, you know, it fit into that.
Well, that's the whole idea that unfortunately, you know, peoples of the third world, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, those who are obviously non-European, are only pawns. They're only spectators in the world on the stage of history. History is made by the North, by European nations, right? When it comes to Cuba's role in Angola particularly, the U.S. knew that Cuba had acted on its own. In fact, Pedro Glaciares, among others, has clearly demonstrated that, for example, the Soviets were taken completely by surprise. The Cubans made this decision on their own. In fact, the Soviets were so upset that, you know, when Raul Castro went to visit, right, the Soviet Union after the Cuban intervention, they wouldn't meet with him for several days, right? This was basically making a point of how disappointed they were, right, or how upset they were. And in fact, for a couple of months, they wouldn't aid the Cuban mission in Angola. So Cuba made its decision on its own, right? And in fact, you know, Henry Kissinger knew that.
Yes.
And there's an article in the New York Times in 1976 where it says that the U.S. State Department knows that Cuba intervened for its own, intervened independent of the Soviet Union, yep. But it's convenient for the United States to maintain the story that Cuba is a puppet for its own propaganda reasons, right? And what's interesting is when Pearl Hayes has published his groundbreaking book, Conflicting Missions, Havana, Washington, and Africa, mm-hmm. 1959 to 1970, when he published that book, The Economist, which cannot be said to be a friend of Cuba, cannot be said to be socialist by any stretch of the imagination, concluded, basically speaking, that he had established very clearly and indisputably that Cuba had intervened independently of the Soviet Union. It was Cuba's own sovereign decision, right? But of course, as some people like to argue, it's not a question that you have to bury the truth forever. As Napoleon said, you bury it long enough so when it's finally revealed, right, it really has no meaning, right, or no significance on events, because the people who were concerned about those events would be very upset are long gone or have passed away, right? And so forth. But the fact is, I don't think that's true in this case. I think it's important for people to understand that a small third world country such as Cuba could act in such a profound way on the stage of world history. The last point I should make about this is when Henry Kissinger found out that the Cubans had successfully intervened in Angola at the request of the Angolan government, okay, he was stunned, right? Mm-hmm. Because he could not believe that a third world country could act independently and be a key factor in the world. The third world was supposed to just be a playground for the interests of the imperial powers. They had no independence and, as you say, no agency, right? And Kissinger was a person who at one point said that history, you know, the axis of history runs from Washington to London to Moscow and to Tokyo, right? And the third world has no role to play. He actually said this once to a Latin American politician.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, it's just that whole Cuitucuana Valley and everything around that really shattered so many myths. I remember in Montreal shortly after it, there was the end conscription campaign out of South Africa.
Yes.
And I remember a young South African conscript was speaking here in Montreal, and he related the anecdote around the whole Cuitucuana Valley fight, where he was there as a South African soldier fighting on behalf of the apartheid regime. And he heard on South African, the SABC, their public broadcaster or whatever, South Africa denying that there were South African troops in Angola. And he was right there fighting and putting his life on the line for, you know, his country. And he sat there listening to the national broadcaster saying, no, there are no South Africans in Angola.
What? Well, the South Africans maintained that lie until they were forced to admit it.
Exactly.
And then they basically said, well, you know, we're not trying to take Cuitucuana Valley.
Yeah.
And they said it. But they tried a number of times, at least there were four major assaults to take Cuitucuana Valley, starting in November and running to March and April of 1988, repeatedly trying to take Cuitucuana Valley and suffering, being repulsed time and time again. And then, of course, what was also happening, because South Africa was a racist regime run by a white minority, increasingly white soldiers began to be killed up there, right, in increasing numbers, and they covered up how many white soldiers were killed, right?
Yeah.
So what you also see is this having an impact on white soldiers themselves, right, refusing to fight, okay, seeing this as a hopeless battle that they can't win.
And that they'd been lied to.
But it also had an impact on mothers, right?
Yes, so the Black Sash movement.
Yeah, there actually becomes in Cape Town, there's actually a demonstration of 900 mothers, right,
yeah,
demanding an end to conscription and so forth. And what happens is basically because as the military reversals take place in Angola, it begins to have repercussions inside South Africa. Repercussions, of course, in the ruling circles of South Africa, repercussions in the society as a whole. And also, very importantly, repercussions on Black South Africans,
mm-hmm,
right? So the Cubans made a documentary called, in English, it's called The Response to the South African Escalation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And pirate copies of that were smuggled into South Africa, and people passed them from house to house watching it, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a famous sermon that's given by Frank Chikane, who's a famous preacher, you know, religious figure in South Africa. And he gives this speech of the sermon, detailing the history, remember, the history of apartheid, the history of racist oppression, and so forth, right? And the struggle. And then he says, then there was Quito Carnival. So Quito Carnival becomes this very important symbolic moment, right? Okay, in terms of the white army has been beaten, the white racist regime has suffered a critical defeat. And it's also this concrete moment as well, where there actually is a fundamental military transformation in the balance of power, which has, as I said before, these incredibly important political repercussions. I don't think it's hyperbole to say that if the South Africans had actually been able to be successful in Quito Carnival, defeating the Angolans, defeating the Cubans, that Angola would have ceased to exist as an independent state, and perhaps the end of apartheid might have been put off 20, 25 years, or maybe not at all.
Right, to say nothing of Namibia's fate. Yeah.
Yeah, Namibia's fate. So it's really a critical moment. And also, what's an important point when it comes to Cuba as well, Fidel Castro repeatedly said that the Cuban Revolution put its very existence on the line in Angola.
Yeah.
Because what happened is, you know, the whole story of this whole thing was that every summer, the Angolan armed forces would launch a summer offensive against UNITA, which was the puppet organization that the South Africans ran as their surrogate in Southern Africa, right? In Southern Angola, right? And the Cubans would always say, listen, if you launch these attacks, obviously you can defeat UNITA, but you have to factor in, will the South Africans intervene? You have to really factor it in, and these offenses would be disastrous. But the Angolans always used to listen to the Soviet advisors. So in 1987, there was a huge arming of the Angolan army. About $1 billion worth of arms came in from the Soviets into the Angolan armed forces. And the Soviets planned with the Angolan military this offensive in summer of 1987. The Cubans said no. You're following the incorrect strategy, and you haven't factored in what will happen if the South Africans intervene. The Cubans disagreed with the advice of the Soviets and told both the Soviets and the Angolans, we wash our hands of the matter, right? Okay, the Angolans launched the offensive, were very successful, on the verge of destroying UNITA, and that's when the South Africans intervened.
Right.
And at that point, as the Angolan forces were retreating, right, back, and the thousands of them were killed, right, retreating back to Quito Carnival, and they asked Cuba for assistance. There's this request that goes from Eduardo Dos Santos to Fidel Castro. The Cubans made a decision. They said, at this point, we are going to deploy enough forces, right, that we can settle this issue once and for all, right, to stop South Africa's intervention. So they not only deployed the forces, they came up with a strategy of holding South Africa at Quito Carnival, and South Africa became obsessed with taking it and developing the outflanking maneuver. But if the Cubans had been defeated, okay, it would have had very serious repercussions internally in Cuba, because don't forget that this battle takes place in 1988. And by 1989, we begin to have the crisis in the Soviet Union Eastern Bloc. And this would have had very profound repercussions morally inside South Africa. So, for example, when the defeat had taken place of the South Africans, the Cubans celebrated, right? And when the Soviet Union collapsed, right, and everybody was predicting the end of the Cuban Revolution and calling Cuba a dinosaur and a relic, the Cubans could point to the fact that, no, they were not. They had played a very important role, not only in the independence of Namibia, not only in the defense of Angolan independence, but also in accelerating the end of apartheid. This demonstrated the relevance and value of the Cuban Revolution. So it played a role in fortifying, right, Cuba's ability to resist, right, during what was called the special period, in which the Cuban economy contracted by over 35% from 1989 to 1994. And they've now left the special period behind, but the special period was an intense test for the Cuban Revolution, for the revolutionary resolve, and I think an important role that played in their ability to resist and to survive, and the fact that they may have had an economic crisis, but they never had an ideological or political crisis, was the fact that the relevance of the Cuban Revolution and value, right, on the world scale was demonstrated on the battlefields in Southern Africa.
Agreed. And I wish we had another half hour, because I had so many other questions for you, to say nothing of Cuba's contemporary role in Africa, but we are out of time. So,
I apologize for talking so much. I'm passionate about this topic.
Clearly, and it was wonderful meeting you on the air. And thank you so much, Professor Saini. And we can continue this conversation another time and take a look at what Cuba is up to here and now today in Africa, and you know what the process prospects are for the future. But for tonight, we're going to have to say goodnight and thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for having me. And I just like to say, long live the memory and legacy and ideas of Fidel.
Absolutely. And just to let you know, we're going to be ending with Mandela in Havana pleading with Fidel to come and visit them in South Africa. So we'll end on that note. And good night and be well.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
This is when they first met.
Before we say anything,
antes de hablar absolutamente de cualquier tema,
you must tell me when you are coming to South Africa.
Me tiene que decir cuándo viene para Sudáfrica.
And we have had a visitor from a wide variety of people.
Una gran cantidad de personas.
And our friend Cuba,
y nuestro amigo Cuba,
which helped us in training our people,
que nos ayudó a entrenar a nuestra gente,
gave us resources to get on with our struggle,
que nos ayudaron tanto en nuestra
trained
lucha,
our people
que
as doctors and so on,
a nuestros médicos.
You have not come to our country.
Cuba no ha venido a visitarnos. Usted no ha ido a visitarnos.
When are you coming?
¿Cuándo viene?
No he visitado a mi patria surafricana.
I haven't visited my South African homeland yet.
La quiero como una patria.
I want it, I love it as
quiero
a homeland.
Y por el pueblo.
I love it as a homeland as I love you and the South African people.
From the moment that Castro took power in Cuba, that government and that people aligned itself with the nationalist movement in Africa. As early as June 59 and July 1960, Fidel and Raul Castro went to Cairo to visit Nasser, now who was then very, very much the moving force with what was going on in the Organization of African Rumin. September 1960, Fidel addressed the UN and Africa about Africa, and he made a big point about this being the focus of his presentation, anti-racist, decolonization, anti-imperialist. His relations with Africa were very close with Abdul Gamer Nasser, Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, what can I tell you? By 1963, when Algeria had its independence, Ahmed Ben Bella gave a presentation to Castro where he said, "We will never forget all you did for our refugees in Morocco and Tunisia. We will never forget how you cared for our orphans and our wounded. Comrade Fidel Castro, the National Liberation Front of Algeria, has awarded only one Medal of Honor, and we have awarded it to you." That was in October 1963. So from the very beginning, Cuba was involved, and not just talking about politics, but actually physically involved in Africa. Ole, I remember you telling a story of being in Angola on Independence Day. I got here with me, Ole Gierstad, who also has much experience with the whole Cuban experience in Africa. And Ole, you talked about how you were in Angola on Independence Day, and Cuba was very, very important part of all that too.
Well, in a sense, Doug, I feel maybe I owe my life to the Cuban troops who had arrived there. Because now, look, we run, it's 11th of November, 1975. It's almost a month after South African troops have invaded Angola.
And
in the middle
the National Day of Independence in Angola
is 11th of November. And the Cubans have arrived about 2 weeks earlier in ancient propeller-driven Britannia planes all the way across the Atlantic and in ships that are landing in a little town, Port-Amouim, south of Luanda. They are trying to cut off the South African advance on Luanda. And they are also moving around to the north where mercenaries paid by the CIA are coming in from the Congo. And I will never remember that because it's the day that Angola declares independence. It's in the evening. I was a journalist. We are summoned to this little, it's a basketball court with gravel in a nondescript part of Luanda. And we are there. There must be maybe a couple of hundred people. There were some journalists in there. There were one or two African ambassadors. I remember from Guinea-Conakry, for example. And Agostinho Neto, the president of Angola, is giving a short speech. And as he is speaking, we can hear the mortar shells are falling all around the city from the north. And we are told to just do our work, get home. We disperse after about half an hour. The Angolan flag goes up on the mast. But I remember leaving there, and I was with a Guinea-Bissau commander whom I had met in Guinea-Bissau. And Guinea-Bissau had sent troops as well, a unit to help the MPLA fight off the South Africans. And I remember him looking at me, and he said, maybe I'll see you again, but we don't know what's going to happen. And help us all.
Well, Mike,
because
gracious.
We didn't know what we were going to wake up to the next morning. But as it were, they stopped the Cubans with the MPLA troops and the guys from Guinea-Bissau. They did stop the South Africans and the mercenaries basically within artillery range and mortar range of the city.
Oh, yeah.
And that is as close as it got. And I woke up the next morning, and we are still breathing. Luanda is scared, but there is no fighting in the streets. And from then on, the pushback begins gradually.
November 11th, 1975. Now, of course, this struggle doesn't start just there and then, does it? This involvement of Cuba.
No, the Cubans, the Cubans had been involved in helping and training earlier. But the direct intervention came as an emergency measure when the South Africans invaded Angola from the south, together with the UNITA rebel movement that had struck an unholy alliance, also supported by the Americans. And of course, from then on, it goes on. And as the war continued, I went to several places of combat where the Cuban soldiers were sort of bracing the Angolan soldiers, who in most cases were new and scared, and the South Africans had long-range artillery and spotter planes. And, I saw Cuban soldiers dying.
Okay.
And they lost, I think, over the next couple of years in Angola, they lost 2,000 troops.
There was all in the name of internationalism. And, of course, that was the whole point of the Cuban intervention. They looked to helping Africa liberate itself. In fact, earlier than that, would have been in the early 60s, Fidel sent Che to visit Africa generally, but more particularly the Congo.
Well, I don't know, Doug, if Fidel actually sent Che.
I think
Che was getting restless. Che, I think, realized he wasn't a great government minister. He didn't like administration and bureaucracy. And what happened is in early 1965, Che Guevara, who was by birth Argentinian,
yes,
he gave up his Cuban citizenship. and he left quietly. He had become an admirer of Patrice Lumumba, the first prime minister of independent Congo. Lumumba had been assassinated by troops paid for by the Americans and helped by white South Africa 3 years earlier. There was a rebel movement in the Congo, and Che quietly left Cuba with 12 fighters whom he had picked and who volunteered. They went to Tanzania. They hooked up with a rebel movement which was led by Laurent Kabinda, who is the father of the current president of the Congo, who Joseph Kabila, who has no intention of leaving, even if his mandate is up next week. Anyway, Che crossed the lake from Tanzania into eastern Congo, South Kivu province, and was later joined by about another 100 Cuban fighters. It was not easy, and Che begins his diary from Congo saying, "This is the story of failure."
Uh-oh.
The diary was published, I think, about 5 years ago. And he also says, "We cannot liberate by ourselves a country that doesn't want to fight." What he found in the Congo was that his experience from Cuba, which essentially when Che fought the Battle of Santa Clara, he had formed a focus, a small unit of fighters who had struck close relationships with people and who were in the area and who were able to build on that and spread from that and take on the troops of Batista and defeat them. In Congo, Che was allied with a movement where the leaders were corrupt, not good fighters, and unreliable. What was even more important, I think, was that he was not the Congolese. Che and his Cuban fighters did not speak the local languages. The peasants in the area in South Kivu didn't know who they were.
That's right.
Didn't trust them. They were afraid of them. And so, hampered by all of this, with the CIA and South African mercenaries helping the Congolese regime of Mobutu Sese Seko, who was then in power, the NSA, which was already existing at the time, intercepting all the radio messages from Che and channeling them to Mobutu's troops. Basically, the intervention was doomed.
And that was that.
And after about 5 months in the Congo, they pulled out. Che pulled out. He did not. Most of his fighters, those who survived, went back to Cuba. Che did not go back to Cuba. He went to Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, where he lived, stayed under the radar for quite a long time. And for the rest of the world, he resurfaces only 2 years later in Bolivia, where he is ultimately killed by Bolivian rangers who have been trained by the Americans.
The rest of that story now being history.
Yeah.
But back to the Angolan situation, Cuba has already been involved in Africa, north, south, center, east, and south, of course. But the Angola thing doesn't finish with 1975 liberation. Along comes a huge invasion of the South Africans. Would that be 82 now? Am I mistaken? Yeah, Cueto Canavale.
No, that was much later. It was in Cueto Canavale, the Battle of Cueto Canavale, which you discussed in this program last week,
was
in 1988.
1988.
Angola, after the South Africans have been initially driven out, UNITA has been pushed back to the southeastern third of the country, the Altiplano, the high plains. The mercenaries from the Congo have been
decimated.
Driven decimated and driven back. But there is a low-level war that continues. And it burns and it burns. And it's only the South Africans which are occupying Namibia, which then is called Southwest Africa, you know, are continuously pushing in to southern Angola with UNITA, trying all the time to destabilize the Angolan government in Luanda.
Right.
So there is an impossible situation. Meanwhile, the Cuban troops have been reduced. They are no longer as active there. We're talking now about the early 1980s and so on. But there is another African adventure that comes up in the time, and most of us forget this. It is the war in the Ogaden. It is the war between Ethiopia and Somalia.
Somalia under Siad Barre.
Somalia under Siad Barre has had conflicts with its neighboring countries because the English, who were the colonial masters there, alongside the Italians, have given parts of what the Somalis consider Greater Somalia. They have given the Ogaden to the Ethiopians, and they have given a big part of Somalia to Kenya.
Yes.
To what is now part of eastern Kenya, which is essentially populated by a Somali-speaking Kenyan population. Well, in 1974, Ethiopia is in turmoil. Haile Selassie, the emperor, you know, the little emperor with the dogs that eat only filet mignon. You know, he has been deposed. There is a military council called the Derg, but there is essentially also a civil war. Many factions are fighting for power. And Somalia, under an authoritarian president, Siad Barre, thinks our moment has come. We're going to get back the Ogaden. And with a large military force, which has been built up with Soviet equipment, this is the Cold War.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the Americans are solidly implanted in Ethiopia, so the Soviets are in Somalia. So Somalia invades Ethiopia, and they take on and they drive deep into the country, deep into Ogaden, and they are threatening the main strategic and logistical points of the Ethiopian southeastern Ethiopia, and the access to the sea. You are right. Now, the new leader of the military council, the Derg, is a self-declared Marxist. His name is Haile Mengistu Mariam. Now, the Soviets are looking at this guy, and they said, wow, he talks a good Marxist language. Maybe we can use him. Maybe he's good for us. And they begin to look at him. They also begin to support him while they are still allied officially with Siad Barre. Well, as that goes on, the Somalis all of a sudden find themselves cut off. And Soviet advisors and equipment are beginning all of a sudden to arrive in Ethiopia. But the war is going very badly for Ethiopia. And so, all of a sudden, by what chain of command, I don't know, but 15,000 Cuban combat troops arrive in eastern Ethiopia.
And those guys understand that kind of warfare.
To beef up. And their commander is General Arnaldo Ochoa, who was the hero of Cuban troops in Angola. And the Cuban contingent is decisive. And the Ethiopians, with the Cubans, drive back the Somalis, and Siad Barre retreats. He's lost the war. It's been a very costly disaster for him. And the Cuban troops did the job.
bachete. Bachete, 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 bachete. Cipriano.
An album that's either called Nova Lima by Afro, or the album is Afro by Nova Lima. But that is not, song number four, Machete, and it's got that beat that absolutely, you cannot mistake that beat for anything else. Oli, more personally, you were in Mozambique for 3 years. You had a very key role there, and you also saw very close up the Cubans on the ground there.
Well, you know, what you see around Africa at the time of the liberation wars is that the Cubans, not only in Mozambique, in Angola, we have talked about. I remember I was in Guinea-Bissau at the end of the liberation war there. And all the fighters who took us around and were our companions, they had been trained in Cuba. I remember my best friend, he became a filmmaker. Well, he was picked out. He was a little guy carrying ammunition. Maybe he was 12 or 13 years old. His name was Sana Nanhada. And one day he was told that you are going to get education. You are going to become something more than a little boy who carries ammunition. And they were on a line, and their leader, Amilcar Cabral, was walking around, and he was saying, you will be a doctor, you will be an engineer, you will be that. And he came to Sana, and he said, you will be a filmmaker. So they got taken down to Conakry, next door in Guinea. There was a ship waiting, and on the ship, they were showing films, I remember. And Sana was saying he would go back to the back of the room and see what the projectionist was doing. Hey. Because he thought the projectionist was making the films. There, as he was showing the films. Anyway, you know, he spent 4 or 5 years at Ilha de Pinhas, I think, where the Cubans had this big installation where there were liberation movement kids studying and being trained.
Not hundreds, but thousands of them.
Thousands of them from all the Portuguese colonies, from Congo, from South Africa, from Zimbabwe.
From Namibia.
Yeah, from Namibia, very many. You're absolutely right. But anyway, what this relationship between Cuba and the Africans went very deep. And when the chips came down, most of the African liberation movements, they really trusted the Cubans. So that when I was living in Maputo in the early 1980s, and the country was under attack by the South Africans, who were physically attacking the country and had created this rebel movement, RENAMO, which was, you know, killing and massacring people.
Barbarians.
The presidential guard of Samora Machel, which you rarely saw, but they were made up of Cubans, Cuban special troops, because as we didn't ask too many questions, but as journalists, we saw, we observed, sometimes we met them. And special occasions. But in the end, things were so precarious in Mozambique at that time that the only combatants Zamora Machel totally trusted were the Cubans.
And on a whole other level, there was Chantal, your wife.
Yeah, there were many other Cubans working in all kinds of civilians, non-military, working in all kinds of fields. And yes, my wife, who was a graphic artist, worked with a brigade. They called them the Brigada.
Yeah.
It was La Brigada de Cubanos. And they were graphic artists because the Cubans are very famous poster makers.
Ooh,
you know, they make
beautiful posters.
Great. And Chantal was a graphic artist, so she was assigned to work with these Cuban men. And there were about a dozen of them. They lived in a house. They were not paid. They lived together. Very, very, their families got salaries back in Cuba to support themselves. But they were there. There was no food in the city. You know, we were all eating little, and they were eating even less because we could go to the black market and do this and do that and somehow get some food on the table. But they couldn't, you know, they didn't have the ability to do that. So they were eating this little dried fish and this bad rice that the World Food Program didn't have any other country to dump in. And it was very demoralizing for
but
them.
But there they were, dedicated to the cause.
And they worked really hard. And what I remember is they didn't have any families with them, you know. So some of them, three or four of them, would always come to our house just to have normal life. Of course, they had no money, but what they did have was rum and cigars.
Uh-huh.
You know, rum without any labels, big cigars without any labels. So it's good for my health that relationship didn't last more for a couple of years. Because by the time we left Mozambique and the Cubans, I was pretty polluted.
Between the rum and the cigars.
So that's a happy souvenir, yes.
There's a story of how Mandela, writing from Robben Island, said it was the first time that a country had come from another continent not to take something away, but to help Africans to achieve their freedom. And Cuba was that country. It was very special. So anybody who tries to tell us differently has better come talk to me and Oli.
Okay.